Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Screen Talk is now available on iTunes. You can head there to subscribe to the weekly show, and you could send us feedback on Twitter. I'm at Eric Cohn, and Ann Thompson is at AK Stanwyck.
Welcome to the latest edition of Screen Talk, IndieWire's podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the chief film critic and senior editor, and I'm joined by Thompson and Hollywood's Ann Thompson, who apparently survived Comic-Con.
I'm made of tough stuff, Eric. I can take Comic-Con.
I was getting a little worried before. Last time we spoke, you were sitting on the floor. There was some guy in a bat suit lording over you, I think.
Very true, but I literally left... You know, I went running off the podcast, apologies, to go into the room, Hall H, and I got to see that incredible Interstellar presentation. So I was just very psyched. Once you get into that hall and you actually get your seat, and if you spend all your time in there and you don't try to do other things like interviews, it's so much fun just seeing all that footage. All that material is really fun to witness.
So as I recall, you said that you were dashing off to the Paramount panel. It was not dubbed the Interstellar panel. This sort of came out of left field.
It was a secret. It was a surprise. So we're sort of slogging through, you know, horrible stuff like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which it was so bad. You know, steer clear as if you didn't already know. I mean, just looking at the materials, you can tell that it... And then who they cast, you know, Megan Fox leaning out of the car window with... And then there was another one, you know, that wasn't the point. The point was to surprise everybody and freak everybody out with Interstellar.
Well, I will be fully enmeshed in the Locarno Film Festival when Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles screens for most media people next week, and I don't feel that bad about it, so... It's interesting to hear you reflect on that because it's not the least bit surprising, and yet of course it was at Comic-Con. You know, like those are sort of the obvious ones. Interstellar is an interesting thing. I mean, I know that this is a science fiction film, but my understanding is neither Chris Nolan nor Matthew McConaughey had ever been there. I mean, it's almost like a gray area whether or not this is a Comic-Con kind of movie, right?
Not at all. There's no question at all that it totally is. They were right to bring them there, and they both should have been there by now. And Nolan looked at least like he was happy to be there. It's you know, he's heading into 2001 territory, and he paid due homage to Stanley Kubrick. But he's also got a family story. The idea basically is that Matthew McConaughey has always yearned to be an astronaut, and when the call finally comes, which is all about, you know, saving the planet, you know, it's like Armageddon or something. When the call comes, he's going to be away for years. He's going to be away for a long time. He's going to miss his family who he really cares about. So is he going to save the world, or is he going to, you know, and ditch his family or stay home? So that's what obviously he goes, and Anne Hathaway is in there with him. And judging from the success of Gravity and whatever it is that Nolan is capable of pulling off in the way of this kind of space feature with emotions, I think it looks fabulous.
Well, I'm absolutely looking forward to this movie. I guess what seems interesting to me is the contrast between something like this, which sounds like brainy science fiction, even if you don't necessarily like science fiction, and the other kind of stuff at Comic-Con, which is much more blatant in terms of, you know, appealing to a certain crowd. So what are your impressions now that you've seen these guys talk about it in this kind of forum about, you know, the kind of appeal for this movie? I mean, are there going to be a lot of different people who get into it?
I'm going to put it right on the level with Gravity.
That's big.
Which is a huge, you know, Gravity wasn't a stupid movie. Gravity didn't pander. Gravity didn't cater to some kind of stupid demo. I think the greatest movies are the ones that somehow manage to be simple enough and ambitious enough to appeal to everyone without being stupid. And by the way, I want to say something about Comic-Con. I have this feeling, I would suggest to you, Eric, that you would feel right at home at Comic-Con. The geeky, you know, the universe of movie, you know, Hall H is pretty much about the, it's either the smart TV demo, you know, happy and thrilled to see the whole cast of Game of Thrones talking about their favorite TV series, or, you know, Walking Dead or whatever, or it's, you know, people just thrilled to see all the Marvel people up there. You know, it's, in fact, I would say it's a smart demo. I wouldn't say it's a stupid demo.
And to be clear, I did not use the word stupid. And though it may have come across that way, I don't mean to be disparaging about this crowd in particular. In fact, I've grown up as an amateur cartoonist. I am a comic book geek at heart. And I've been to New York Comic Con, which I understand is kind of a microcosm of that thing. I relate to that tendency. What I think is interesting, though, is that, you know, this was an event that was created with an actual indie sensibility for comic book people that's, you know, now used as a marketing mechanism for certain kinds of movies, irrespective of whether or not they speak to the kind of broader sensibilities of somebody who likes comics, or the kind of, like, marketing sort of boiled down notion of the comic book sensibilities.
This is what I'm trying to say too. I see what you're saying. Well, you could have a Comic-Con where Watchmen plays through the roof,
right,
and then it goes out and doesn't do business. And you can have a Comic-Con where Edgar Wright is absolutely beloved, or Joss
right.
Whedon is beloved. Now, Joss Whedon made one movie, you know, Firefox. What was it called?
Firefly,
thank you. Firefly, which...
See, I know this stuff. This is...
You do.
I know you do. But, so
and then, the and then is, the other one, you know, the Edgar Wright one that didn't play, you know, played very well at Comic-Con, but
Scott Pilgrim. Which, by the way, I love those comics. I read them years before he finished that movie. So I have my credentials here, and when I see Interstellar, I watched some of the video online of the kind of rock star welcome those guys got. I was just thinking, well, is this a gamble where the studio is saying, we need these guys on board for this particular kind of movie? You know, I'm just trying to read behind the scenes a little bit.
Well, they're marketing the movie to the perfect demo, but this is a narrow demo compared to what they're going to want in the end. But this was right in the Comic-Con sweet spot, no question about it.
Well, I have to tell you, I know there was a huge new trailer that dropped this week. I have not watched it. I actually have a lot of respect for the element of surprise, as I know Nolan himself does. And I'm always speculative about the way that trailers impact expectations, as somebody who both writes critically about films and also reports on them, because, you know that the only way to really look at this thing is when it's done. And so I'm, especially with a movie like this, which has these kinds of expectations, I'm wary about getting this trailer into my brain right now. Although I realize...
Oh, don't worry about it. It's very introductory, this particular one. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do closer to release, but this doesn't give too much away. Exactly. One of the things that I hate about movie marketing, and the studios are, you know, totally guilty as charged in this area, is that, unfortunately... usually closer to release, not at this stage, because this is coming out in November. But basically, the more they show in a trailer, the better it does. And that's unfortunately statistically true. And that's why they tend to give too much away. So I understand your reluctance.
One example of that actually is a movie opening this week, which is Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, I mean, to get away from the trailer issue, it does kind of spoil some stuff there, but what's interesting about that one is that it is a Comic-Con kind of a movie, but what I realized when I was watching it was that it's everything that's really interesting about it has nothing to do with the more comics element of it, the more like kind of spectacular elements. It's more just like how funny and kind of, you know, character-driven some of the plot is. It's an interesting kind of dichotomy, almost like a schizophrenic movie. I don't know if you had that experience watching it, but that was my takeaway.
I have to say that I never had any exposure at all to the Guardians of the Galaxy universe. And I don't think I even ever saw a trailer before I saw the film. I knew very little. I remember seeing the Guardians of the Galaxy introduction at Comic-Con a year ago.
Right.
And I was like, I didn't know these characters. I didn't know who they were. So when I finally saw the movie, I have to say I was just like thrilled and delighted. It was at the ArcLight with the best sound and screen and you know, 3D and the whole nine yards. And I had the same feeling about everyone in that room, that they were all having a just deliciously good time. And when they all came out of the theater and were talking with each other and saying, oh, I like this and I like that, it made me happy. It made me feel that feeling when you, A, know that something's going to be an enormous blockbuster that's going to play to the entire world and could actually beat Michael Bay's Transformers, and I'm rooting for it to do so. That movie's going to do repeat business. I would rush back to see it a second time because I was in a world, it's like Avatar, a world where you want to be.
It is enjoyable. I mean, it's interesting you talk about the Guardians, you know, not being familiar with them. They were kind of like marginalized in the comics for a long time, which is interesting because it actually gave Marvel the liberty to do something that had less the onus of expectations outside of the more limited fan base. And that's one of the reasons why a filmmaker like James Gunn, who's made these interesting smaller movies, he's a former Troma guy, he did Slither, which was kind of a B-movie, and
with humor, Super, though. He's got comedy chops.
Yeah, and Super, which was actually kind of a superhero satire, but it also had like a interesting realism to it. And so you can see that kind of energy in the movie, and that's what works about it. What's less interesting to me is every time it kind of just turns into another battle. I mean, there aren't any action scenes that stand out in my mind the way that, you know, it's funny when this animated raccoon voiced by Bradley Cooper gets drunk in the bar and threatens to shoot the place up. You know, I remember that scene, but it could be anywhere in the movie.
The thing is that he is, I would say that what's good about Marvel, and one of the reasons why this is a better movie than the studio version of it would be, the Hollywood studio version as opposed to the Marvel version, is that it actually was organically developed, written by one of their young writers in training. They have an internship program for 2 years, and this Nicole Perlman, I think her name is, actually picked, because she likes sci-fi, she wanted the cosmic comic, she picked this comic, and she worked on the script and honed down the characters and everything, and then when it was looking really good and they recognized how good it was, they brought in other words, she had the freedom to just make it what she wanted it to be for a long, long time, and then they brought in James Gunn and he took it over and did his little number on it, put his magic on it. But that is so different, so 50 million times different from the way that anything like that would be done.
Plus, it also raises a question of, oh, hey, this is a superhero story that was sort of written by a woman, which doesn't happen too often.
No, and I would suggest to you that there are a lot of aspects of it that show that it was written by a woman. But what it's also like is, if you look at Joss Whedon and the Avengers, you recognize that what he understood was who each one of those characters was, and he gave them each a story, and it is finally character-based. All of them are.
Right.
Thor, Captain America, Iron Man, they are all character-based, and they know exactly what the tone is, what the universe is, and they never deviate from that,
right.
And that's why this is so good. So that it isn't about the action. The action isn't the most important thing.
It's not, and yet it is there in a way that I think is frustrating to me because of what the kind of imbalance of quality. Now, to bring up another example, which I know you've seen, in Luc Besson's Lucy, right? This is a ridiculous movie. I called it brainy dumb, right? It's brainy dumb because it acts like a smart movie, but it doesn't make any sense. And yet it's so ridiculously entertaining for a lot of things that happen that are visual, I would posit.
Right. And that's what it's about.
And that's much more exciting to me overall, I think.
Really? You would put Lucy, I would agree with a lot of what you just said about Lucy. What is exciting about it is that Scarlett Johansson has been very smart about her career choices. She's a smart girl, smart woman. And she has not made too many mistakes, and she, you know, Under the Skin was good. to be, you know, being willing to be in a Marvel movie and get herself some action chops as Black Widow, very smart. You know, she is now in the upper echelons and, you know, is a major star. She carried Under the Skin. That movie did as well as it did, however well that was, because of her. You know, it would have done worse if someone else was in it. I think she is the main reason to see the movie, but it is deliriously fun at the same time that I do decry the mayhem around her. Why would this incredibly brilliant person willingly, you know, destroy so many people?
But, you know, you can actually have a conversation about that. I mean, there might even be an answer to that if you dig deep enough into the material. Not to say it's necessarily there, but
it opens... I doubt that.
You know, it's a stupid movie. I'm not saying that per se. I'm saying that I'm more excited by something that is that kind of unruly and kind of go for broke extreme in terms of the way that it's experimenting with various possibilities. And something like Guardians, where the narrative is relatively pat, it has certain rhythms that I've seen a million times before, including that big giant thing in the sky falling down being the climax. You know, and of course the opening for sequels and all that stuff. It just so happens that it's better than a lot of those things.
It's more fun to watch an origin myth than it is to watch a sequel.
And there is that as well.
That is the deal. And so it's fun and exciting and you don't know, you know, they're establishing the characters and you're learning about them at the same time that it's incredibly derivative and based on the DNA of movies like Star Wars. And you can just go through the whole thing and say, all right, that, although I will argue that while Groot may appear to be a lot like Chewbacca, we talked about this before with Andy Serkis and Planet of the Apes. And I really think that they should have a best character, best animated character Oscar category, because Vin Diesel and Groot deserve to win.
And wouldn't it be great to see Vin Diesel and Andy Serkis go head-to-head as their characters in award season, Caesar versus Groot? The studios really need to be thinking about this. There's some major potential, or at least late-night television. I mean, I just want to see it happen. Well, let's turn to, since you're bringing up the award season, we touched on this a little while back, but A Most Wanted Man, the last real leading role for Philip Seymour Hoffman, is doing really well. And you published an interview with Howard Cohen from Roadside Attractions about you know, the possibility that maybe they could do some kind of awards campaign for this movie. It seems like maybe this is more of a reality now because people are seeing this thing.
Well, part of it is a little bit of the Heath Ledger factor, I suspect. You know, there's a slight curiosity, but what's really sad about it, as you pointed out in your review, is that he gives one of his best performances. You know, he really elevates this movie.
Yeah, he deserves it. He really deserves it.
But I've also seen people respond. The movie has I like the movie a lot, and it's doing extremely well because it has all these great actors in it, and it is a Jean Le Carré thriller of a certain international kind. People know the genre. They enjoy this kind of movie. And the studios used to make it. That was Howard and I talked about how that realm of production has moved to the sort of indie financing overseas model for movies like this. But it's a relatively commercial movie. But it depends on the competition.
And at the very least, I would hope that, you know, the Gothams and the Spirit Awards find a way to single out this role, because it definitely, you know, there's just no way that we're not going to get to the end of the year and not still have a reason to discuss this thing.
I mean, well, the 10 best lists, the critics are going to have to see that this is one of the 10 best films if that's going to happen. But I would also say that the film is a little flat and he is really, really good. But I think some people are making a kind of looking at what happened after he made the movie as a way of explaining what he's like in the movie, which I really dislike. I want to be able to say he is giving a performance. This is not the real Philip Seymour Hoffman or anything. Even though he's world weary, even though he's tired, even though he's fighting against the establishment, I think we shouldn't read too much into his performance in that regard.
So another thing that you talked about in your Howard Cohen interview is VOD, and there were some questions about, you know, the prospects of various kinds of movies on VOD and sort of how that marketplace compares with the theatrical one. And you talked a little bit about Snowpiercer, which this week apparently has made around $4 million on VOD, according to the numbers that Radius is putting out there. So this has gone from a story that was more speculative to one that really does have hard data, but it still feels kind of like the sort of thing that everybody's looking at and sort of uncertain what to do about. You know, like, we're not necessarily going to see more Snowpiercer releases, right?
That was an unusual situation where Harvey Weinstein was willing to let go of the potential for a certain kind of theatrical upside to, in order to perform this experiment. And he obviously thought it was very risky to put $25 million into a 2,500 screen release. Now, if he had, maybe it would have come out. But in any case, what it shows is what you can do with a commercial movie on VOD. And what Howard was talking about is that there are certain movies with good cast, mostly. It's just safer to go on VOD than you know, if they're not. You have to have serious confidence to go out theatrically, which he did with A Most Wanted Man.
Right.
And because he had enough cast and he had enough commercial elements, and he was right. He was perfectly right. But the question is, I think, what we talk about is the theaters demand a 3-month window, a 90-day window for between, you know, the first run theaters, the big theater chains, the best theaters. And if you want to go on VOD, what happened with Snowpiercer was that it had to settle for less, you know, not the top rung theaters. And so its theatrical upside was cut short by the short window between theatrical and, it was just 2 weeks.
Right.
Between theatrical and VOD. So the real question, what if you paid and expended money to brand a commercial movie for 6 weeks and went on VOD? That is, and if the theaters know you're going to do it, they won't let you book their theaters. That's the deal, you know? So you can't lie to them.
Well, and what I'm sensing is that there is this increasing shift towards the idea that the people willing to experiment with windows are the good guys, and the bad guys in this conversation are the ones who are just afraid or unwilling to try anything different.
No, there's a way of defending the theater point of view, because it's the only way they have aside from concessions, but that still requires that people show up at the theater. That's the only way they make money. They have no other options. The studios can do whatever they want, even the studios, but they're looking at the indies to do all of their sort of experiments.
I'm completely sympathetic to the theaters myself, and I did a piece where I got reactions from a lot of different ones, and clearly there's reason for them to be skeptical or resistant because of their own business model. But I think what's interesting is you look at how, for example, this week it was announced that Ted Sarandos of Netflix is going to get a special Gotham Award from IFP this year. That, to me, is a statement of, you know, this person who is in the purely in the digital space, who's pushing on the Windows question, you know, that's the kind of thing that we want to celebrate. And that suggests to me that with that sort of thing happening, with the Snowpiercer thing, that there is a shift in the indie landscape to the idea of experimenting with Windows more and more.
This is not news, Eric. They've been doing this for a long time.
It's not a question of whether
IFC
they've been doing.
And Magnolia and the indies are the ones at Gotham. Gotham is an indie.
Sure.
Indie celebrates.
It's not news to do that per se, but it does seem like there's more conversation now about it in a more public setting. Whereas before it was kind of an insular dialogue. And the fact that it's more public could also have an impact on the way that filmmakers perceive these things, the way that kind of general moviegoers eventually perceive these things. And
there's another way of looking at it, which is that Netflix, at this stage of the game, you know, very much in the digital streaming space, they made that switch a while ago, is picking up more content, more indie content. They're doing docs. And, you know, not only did they do the Oscar-nominated The Square and Mitt, but they picked up from Sundance the E-Team, and they picked up Virunga.
Which is great. I love that documentary.
I can't wait to see. I loved E-Team. I saw that. And I also love this movie called Mission Blue, which they picked up, which I saw. And it's this is very much a question of competing directly with other distributors for this, you know, putting things out theatrically and then putting them out on Netflix. So I think it's wonderful that they're doing that. But it's also a question of how the industry is shifting in such a way that even on the indie side, a lot of the filmmakers and talent that would ordinarily be working their way up through the indies in terms of having careers are heading for television. They're working on House of Cards. They're working on Orange is the New Black. They're working on other things other than indie films.
And it's interesting because I actually just finished binge watching Fargo this week on through my Amazon account. And it's great. It's a fully contained story. It's not the original Fargo, but it did make me wonder, hey, nowadays, if the Coen brothers had come up with the idea of Fargo, this might have been what it looked like. So you really can see that contrast in a very explicit way with today's content.
There are certain filmmakers like Paul Thomas Anderson and the Coens and Wes Anderson and others who can inhabit that space where they can do, you know, whatever they want. Iñárritu, they can command, you know, enough money and coin and distribution largesse to do what they want. But for the most part now, most of these indie filmmakers are heading for TV.
But let's get away from that because we want to recommend some movies that are opening this week. And there actually are some people should check out. Do you want to share your recommendation first?
I love Calvary. And I think I may have talked about it a little bit out of Carlo Vivari, but Brendan Gleeson plays a Catholic priest who is hit, sideways, gobsmacked in the confessional when one of his congregation tells him that he's planning to kill him in a week. He's basically going to get back at him as a representative of the Catholic Church because of some abuse that he has suffered for many years as an altar boy. And I don't mean to make this sound funny. There is a lot that is funny in the movie. And the movie has a kind of over-the-top, stylized sort of quality about it, which some people will like and some people won't, actually. This isn't going to be a movie that is embraced by everyone. And I suspect that how you feel about religion may have some impact on how you react to the movie. I thought it was brilliant.
I have to say, I mean, I liked it quite a bit as well, and I also liked John Michael McDonald's previous movie, which was also with Brendan Gleeson, called The Guard, a very different kind of dark comedy of sorts. But even people who aren't turned on by this thing, I think, will be impressed with Brendan Gleeson's performance. It's maybe his best role. I mean, it's really remarkable what he does with this very sophisticated character. A lot of it's internalized and kind of registers on his face. I have to say, though, my recommendation for this week, completely more to the extreme of it's not for everybody, okay? Like, the movie you're picking is about a priest kind of dealing with the possible end of his life. The movie I'm picking is about a necrophiliac. That would be Child of God. It's directed by James Franco, adapted from the Cormac McCarthy novel from the early 70s, and it stars this guy, Scott Hayes, in really his first big movie role as this character who's sort of based on Ed Gein's The Serial Killer, but sort of an amalgam of different kinds of people, who loses his home, ends up kind of living the woods as this apparent crazy person who kills and rapes women, among other things. But what the movie does, I think, in a surprisingly sophisticated way, is that it dares you to go with the experience of watching this person, and if not sympathize with his psychosis, then come to understand it. And Franco, I find to be actually developing a very interesting strain sensibilities as a filmmaker that's not necessarily there as a performance that reflects what he's been doing in academia, which is unwrapping certain constructs, certain things that restrict you from appreciating or accessing a movie in a certain way by confronting things in a very particular fashion. And this movie, I think, does it better and more coherently than anything he's done before, partly because Scott Hayes is so good. It's really a fascinating tour de force performance, but also because the film is strung together almost, quite beautifully in this very macabre fashion, so that you're swept up in the kind of odyssey of this strange man lost in the woods. It's almost abstract. And so Franco, maybe the conversation has shifted a little bit. I think he's gotten a bad rap for being this freewheeling experimenter who tries all these different media. This is the first movie that he has made that I think really totally works. And so if you were to start somewhere with his filmography, I realize a lot of people haven't explored it that much. I would say this is the time to start paying attention. As his career continues to develop, I think as a filmmaker, he is continually going to be a source of intrigue. And so there is something worth seeing here, and I hope that people can get over that hump with him, because he is actually a really interesting figure. He's in The Interview, that really bizarre comedy that's pissed off North Korea with Seth Rogen.
I can't wait to see that.
And it looks great.
That's Rogen and Goldberg. My question for you on Franco, the director, I've seen some of his shorts. How many films has he actually directed at this point?
You know, I can call that up very easily with IMDb, but what I could tell you is that there's been more than I think a lot of people realize. I mean, he's been making movies for, I guess, more than a decade. I mean, I'm actually in front of a computer now, and I'm looking. But yeah, I mean, his first feature that he directed was The Ape in 2005, which was not very good. But he's done a lot of stuff since then, including a really interesting black and white documentary called Saturday Night about behind the scenes of Saturday Night Live, which was in distribution limbo for a while but might be coming out on Hulu. He did a biopic of Sal Mineo, which was interesting. It didn't totally work. Interior Leather Bar, he co-directed, which is a kind of fascinating look at sexual identity. And then last year at Cannes, he had this Faulkner adaptation, As I Lay Dying, which was told in this very elaborate split-screen fashion that didn't all work, but was, I think, daring in a sense, because it actually forced you to engage with the way Faulkner tells stories as opposed to just trying to tell the original story. So you can go do your own research and figure out like exactly how many things this guy's put out there. There's a lot of it, and it doesn't all work, but there is sophisticated artistry there. And to me, that's what's really valuable is that, you know, you can't just write off somebody who's trying to do something different if you look at the particulars and there is something there. That's my personal plea. But, you know, that being said, if he makes a real stinker next time, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised. And the Sound and the Fury, which is his next Faulkner adaptation, will be on the fall season circuit. So I will definitely bite my tongue if there is reason to be hesitant about this guy. I'm just going to put it out there. There might be something more than what people have perceived so far.
Well, one of the things about him as an actor, which is sort of interesting to me, is that he's better as a naturalistic actor who truly inhabits a character than he is, and he's a very good actor, just think about Milk, you know, some of the roles that he's played that are really good, as opposed to being a movie star, like the way he was in Oz. I did not care for the kind of performance he gave there. I don't think he's the kind of guy who's looking to be liked so much as he is to really dig into a role that interests him, and I'm sure that applies to his films as well.
All right, well, we've covered a lot of ground here this week. Next week, I'll be in the Locarno Film Festival, and I'll have a lot to talk about there, and hopefully I'll be coherent in certain points in time. Just a reminder to people that we are on iTunes, and we'd love to hear what you think, so feel free to review the show on there or find us on Twitter and give us your thoughts. We can take it. So with that in mind, Anne, it's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Eric.
Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.